This episode of Before the Train Wreck podcast is brought to you by the Grondike Soap Company. Guys, I use Tactical Soap and God of War Beard Oil every single day. Tactical Soap is a handmade natural product made in the United States of America from ingredients you can actually pronounce, not endocrine disrupting chemicals that are going to lower your testosterone. Both the soap and beard oil is infused with bioidentical pheromones that are designed by a clinical psychologist and pheromone expert to maximize attractiveness to the opposite sex. Go visit coopersoap.com and that will automatically apply 10% off your order. Consider grabbing one of the trifecta packs to save even more. If you are a bearded man and want a majestic beard like yours truly, the God of War Beard Oil is hands down the best beard oil product I've ever used. Gentlemen, this is the most manly handmade soap that we know of. Other soaps are going to get you clean. This one will get you dirty. Again, you're going to want to visit coopersoap.com now and place your order. That's Cooper, C-O-O-P-E-R, soap.com now. All right, what is up? We got an episode for you, which promises to be amazing. We've got a 40-year-old Catholic virgin on with us tonight for Before the Train Wreck, episode number 57. I thought it'd be prudent to actually invite Rollo Tomasi on for this one because he's just working on the finishing touches of his fourth book, which deals with religion and the red pill. And I got a good friend of mine on. We're going to call him Augustine, who I've known for a year, who I just found out the other week is, in fact, a 40-year-old virgin. He is a, we're going to keep him anonymous for the purpose of this broadcast, but he's a very successful entrepreneur, runs multiple businesses, does very, very well in life. But when we were talking in a private forum the other week amongst some of our peers, we had no idea that he was a virgin at 40, by choice. You know, he's a voluntary celibate. And I had some current concerns about his views on marriage and religion and what could potentially go sideways for him with the beliefs that he was using or the lens in which he was viewing entering a marriage. Because there's a lot of stuff that I see, and I was actually concerned to the point where, you know, I talk to a lot of guys at some point, you know, they get really down and out on life, and you end up sometimes having conversations with guys that think about putting a noose around their neck or a muzzle in their mouth, and I worry about stuff like that. I know that Augustine's just fine from that perspective, but I wanted to open this dialogue for Before the Train Wreck because I think it's a Before the Train Wreck sort of narrative as to how a belief system could potentially go sideways for you in the real world when it's subscribed to an old world book of beliefs. So welcome, Rollo. Welcome, Augustine. How you guys doing?
Hey, hey. Good. Good to be
here. Great, Rich.
So,
topics.
Yeah, I figured you'd love this one. So, do you want to kind of frame the background story to this, Augustine, and maybe tell these guys?
And before we get started, I want everybody to know that we have actually met Augie. We've met before in real life before, so we know who we're talking with. Just because you don't see his face, we know who he is. Both of us have met him in person.
Yep. I appreciate you saying that, Rollo. And technically us Catholics, we pronounce it Augustine. Augustine's the more feminine pronunciation, but
okay.
Yeah. Augustine, yeah. But you can call me Augie. But no, I appreciate that, guys. You verifying that I'm a real guy. And just to put it out there, I'm not a MGTOW incel, and I'm not here to make enemies with any group or demographic of the manosphere. Like, I'm not trying to get heat from the MGTOWs or from the TradCons or from the Black Pill guys or the PUAs or anything like that. I'm what I refer to as a vol cell, like a voluntary celibate. And it's by choice. And I distinguish, like, for me, there's two different kinds of experiences. I distinguish between dating experience and sexual experience. Okay. And, not all dating experience is necessarily sexual experience, in my opinion, although you could say it's, you know, you're participating in the sexual marketplace. So I don't have any sexual experience per se. Like, I've never had, you know, vaginal intercourse with a woman, but that's been by choice. I've been in lots of relationships. I've dated lots of women. I've asked lots of women out, and most of them have no clue that I'm a virgin. Like, they think that I'm used to interacting with women because I'm not afraid of women. I'm not intimidated of them. I'm a successful guy. I'm a decently looking guy. You guys have both met me in person and seen me. So none of this is involuntary. And I'm huge on words. So when I say that I'm a vol cell, like I'm a voluntary celibate, that word celibate starts with chele, C-E-L-I, which comes from the same root word of celestial. It's a chastity is a heavenly virtue. And like it says in Matthew 22:30, which I believe you're going to be quoting in your upcoming book, Rollo, on religion and the red pill, you know, Jesus actually said that there's no marriage in heaven. So the idea of living an existence without sexual intercourse, it's a foretaste of heaven. And it brings you close to God. That's one of the reasons why I do it. But basically at the core of who I am, guys, I'm sure a lot of people are going to watch this and think that I'm beta, think that I'm, like I said, MGTOW, blue pill, purple pill. That's really for the public to decide. I still believe that I could be a red pill virgin at 40. Like I truly do believe that, because for me, the red pill, I don't agree with all of it, obviously, like sex outside of marriage and things like that. But at the core of who I am is my Catholicism. Like I put that before every other part of my identity. So before I'm a man, before I'm an entrepreneur, before I'm a conservative Republican, even before I'm a black man, I'm a Catholic. Okay. So all those other identities or sub identities, those are just clothes that I wear on top of that. So I just kind of wanted to start with that. That's why I'm a celibate. It goes against my faith. And it's not easy. You know, it's as hard as it sounds, guys. The idea of not having sex, it's as hard as it sounds, but the grace of God enables me to do that. And like I said, that's what sustains me in that. So
let me ask you a question. How do women respond when you get involved with them, you know, romantically, you start dating and they find out that you're a virgin?
Sure. Well, sooner or later it comes to that point. I mean, you know, they really like it. And in a way, they have kind of an honor. Like if I get to know them well enough and we kind of develop a relationship, kind of like how Rollo teaches, like women love the idea, or they love the notion that they were the ones with their female intuition that was able to quote unquote figure a guy out. I noticed that a lot of them take that approach where they almost feel kind of honored to possibly be the woman to take my virginity from me. Mm-hmm. And I've even had women tell me that. They say, oh, if we work out, it'd be great for me to, you know, you to give me your virginity on our wedding night. Like they feel kind of honored by it.
And, I know Rollo's really focused there on his note taking. He's got some questions coming up, but, sure. So you want to preserve your virginity for your wedding night. I haven't met a female virgin in forever. I can't remember the last time I've met a female virgin, but, yeah. I'm assuming most women that you've dated haven't been virgins. So how do you reconcile, if you plan to get married, getting married to somebody that has already had sex?
Sure. That's a very fair question, Rich. And I'm not going to lie. That was actually, it's funny because one of the commenters said that I'm setting myself up for red pill rage one day. Mm-hmm. That was actually when I discovered the red pill about 3 years ago. That was the focal point of my red pill rage.
Because you were pissed off because there was no female virgins.
Yes, I was. Okay. I'm not going to lie about that. Because, and I'm thinking, man, what an unfair trade. You know, I waited all this time and I'm basically going to be her first. You know, she's going to be my first, but I may be her fifth or sixth or whatever. I did go through some rage on that.
Yeah. All right. Rolla, did you want to hop on here?
Yeah. Sorry. I'm a copious note taker here, and I figured I better do this so I can get my thoughts all in line. Okay, so here's what I think, and I have I've talked to guys who, particularly doing the research for book four, who either it's just I realize this is going to be anecdotal, okay, because I know that a lot of the guys, it's like I'm not doing like, you know, polls or anything like that. It's just anecdotal stuff and what I can sort of glean, I guess, statistically from other people's research. But it's been my experience that a lot of guys, when they get to a certain point in their virginity, they tend to either seek out God or they seek out some sort of, I think really what it comes down to is making necessity their virtue. And sure. What that means is that when guys realize that they're kind of on the low end of the stick with respect to being low SMV, I mean, I know what you look like. I know why you are where you're at right now. And not to be a prick about anything, but I mean, when you get to a certain point, I think it's almost, I've written several essays about this, but the one that comes to mind is I've got an essay called You Need Sex. And I, from that essay, I talked to a lot of guys that I either I knew or who were like who had hit me up, and they were very religious. They're in similar situations to you, although they weren't like 40 years old. They might've been like 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And either they were completely sexless and completely celibate, or they were they married very early because their religious belief, convictions, I should say. Believe, I want to make sure I make a distinction between that too, because I do this in the book as well. Is that there should be a distinction between like just basic belief, because everybody has beliefs, okay? But convictions right. are another thing, and that's like the actions and the behaviorism that follows from those beliefs is conviction. At least that's the way I'm defining it. My people will probably call me to the carpet for that, but there does need to be a distinction there, because a lot of people can be convicted about something and you can feel guilt or you can feel whatever, and you can change your behavior accordingly. Or you can have like a religious belief and you say, well, you know, I don't believe in sex before marriage kind of thing. And it's almost like today, in this day and age, I understand why guys still cling to that, because it almost seems like they're making that necessity into a virtue. So when you can't get laid, it sounds a whole lot better, not just to other people. I'm not saying it's something that you have to, like, you know, it's like something that you have to present to someone else. It's something you have to present to yourself. So sure. you're going, well, I'm not having sex because this is the way I believe, when in fact, you know, it's really your necessity, and it's difficult. Like, for the most part, like when we talk to and it's hard to have these conversations, particularly with MGTOW and with Black Pill guys, because every one of these guys, particularly like maybe older MGTOW guys, would like you to believe that if they wanted to, they could go out and get laid tomorrow if they wanted to, because they're so on top of their game. And then you find out that really they probably couldn't, and that their belief or their conviction is now MGTOW. It's now right. that belief set. And so really, again, it's they're making MGTOW their virtue rather than religion their virtue.
Absolutely. But
it's been made that way because of their necessity, which is let's be honest. I have written about this a million times as well. It's like when we talk about the 80-20 rule, or even 85-15 rule now, I think, 85% of guys are beta men. They're guys who are, I don't even call them beta at this stage. Let's just say they are low SMV men. When you look at statistics, like say the ones from like, what is it? Dataclysm. When you look at the OkCupid research, and now we live in a time where we can get hard data on this now. It's not just us guessing. And when you look at the statistics from the general survey, General Statistics Survey? I can't remember. It's GSS. I don't remember what the acronym actually stands for, but it's like guys between the ages of 18 and 29 are having less sex than any other generation that came before them, if they're having sex at all. So when somebody says, well, I'm not having sex because I don't want to have sex because I have a religious belief, or I'm MGTOW, or the juice ain't worth the squeeze, or whatever, you know, add in whatever reason you want there, I have to be kind of critical of that. I have to look at that from a position of like, could these guys be getting laid if they wanted to, or is it just simply them making necessity their virtue?
Let me ask a question, because I'm the only non-religious guy in this panel tonight. Rolla, would you consider yourself a man of God? Like, what religion do you subscribe to?
I fit in. I think I'm a Christ follower. Put it that way.
Okay, and so it's pretty much the same book that Augie follows.
More or less. I think that, you know, there's got to be a distinction made between Protestant and Catholic, of course. But okay. I think Catholicism tends to be a little bit more ritualistic. I don't know. I don't know how familiar you are with it. The thing is, when I discuss my faith in book four, I'm pretty upfront about it. I'm saying, I don't know where I fit in, to be honest with you. I know what my basic faith is, but I don't know what franchise I would belong to. Okay. Because I'm not a Bible literalist for sure. So I believe you can have like objective metaphorical truth, and that doesn't necessarily have to be objective truth. You know what I mean? Like the stories in Genesis or parables and all that other stuff teach a true story, but do I think that they are actual, you know, things that occurred at, you know, 2000 years ago, 6,000 years ago or whatever it is? No, I don't. I think that they, okay. those are metaphorical truths.
So if,
if you're drinking virtually the same Kool-Aid, why don't you believe that you should preserve virginity for marriage? Because, I mean, you obviously weren't a virgin when you got married, right?
Yeah, clearly. I'll tell you the difference here is that I think that a lot of when we talk about like rules against like premarital sex or things that we used to think were normal. Like if you go and you look in the Old Testament, polygamy was normal. Mm-hmm. So you look at Abraham. That was a normal thing for him to have two wives and concubines, and that was just what was going on in the Middle East back in the time of the Old Testament. And now we would look at that from Christian Protestants would look at that, or I would presume probably Catholics would look at that, and they would go, well, that's wrong. That's, you're supposed to be one man, one woman. That's how it was meant and intended to be. And, and then everything becomes open to interpretation. Again, one of the reasons why I'm not a Bible literalist is because everything becomes open to interpretation. When we talk about creationism or we talk about Adam and Eve in the garden and all this other stuff, everybody wants it to tell you that it's, literally this is what happened in Genesis, and then everything else from Exodus on all the way through is open to interpretation. And we can, that's how you get Christian feminists and you get all these franchises of Christianity on getting away from what is really sort of a basic faith and understanding what it's all about. So, I get into a little bit more detail in that in the book, but I'll tell you the thing is like, I understand why, sanctions against premarital sex exist. Because from a latent purpose perspective, it makes sense. Because when you have, and we're learning this right now because we have the pill, we have the sexual revolution, and we're learning some kinds of lessons right here. What happens when we don't have buffers on hypergamy? When we don't have buffers on women's behaviors, which is what we don't. It's like it's free reign. And now what's happened is we have, you look at the social changes and the political changes and everything else that has happened in the wake of the sexual revolution. And it all happened by doing one thing, which was giving unilateral control of the human reproductive process to women.
And by that, you mean the birth control pill.
Birth control pill. And then in the wake of that, of course, we have fempowerment, we have abortion, we have Duluth model feminism, we have child support laws, we have no-fault divorce, we have all this other stuff that sort of flows. If you look at where all of the rise, if you look at the graphs for like the rise in like abortions or divorces and everything else, it all starts right around 1965. And what happened around then was the sexual revolution happened in the wake of the pill. And that was one of the most radical, I think, shifts in human history. And we're still trying to figure out what the fallout was. But when like somebody says, I don't believe in premarital sex, I understand why. I understand the logic behind that because I know because I've had sex with virgins before. I've had sex with, 40 plus women before. And I understand what happens when you have sex right now, because I've said this before when I talk about like things like alpha widows, right? Why would we have, wouldn't it be great if we could just say, okay, ladies, you got to keep your legs shut. Guys, you can't have sex until you have made a commitment. What happens in that, if that's a social arrangement between men and women, which I don't think is tenable. So that's why I'm sort of like saying, I understand the logic behind it. I just don't think it's tenable in this day and age, but it makes sense because if you go and you look at, and you and I have talked about this before, is when women have multiple sex partners, they have a lessened ability to pair bond with their, with their husbands. Usually because they've had, 10, 20, whatever, however many lovers that they've had before. And amongst that pool of guys that came before you, 1, 2, 5, whoever might have been alphas that she sort of imprinted on, and you were just sort of the second choice that she had. And therefore, if you could eliminate that, if you could make a rule that says you can't have sex with multiple partners, that makes sense certainly for women and men. But like today, we want to say, well, that's a repression, or you're repressing women's ability to choose for themselves. Another thing, prearranged marriages. Now, that's not anything. Usually that's not anything that has to do with Christianity, but in Indian cultures, like, that side, it makes sense. It made sense because we said, okay, if I have a daughter, which I do, and you have a daughter, and you said, I don't want her to marry some scumbag I'm going to go find the guy that I think that you should be with, that I want to pair my family up with, that I want to, you know, I think that this will be a good union kind of thing. Granted, you know, in the past that was abused, but the concept is a good idea because I don't want my family to be connected to another family because my daughter made a bad romantic decision.
Yeah.
And had a baby, and now I'm hooked up to, like, my family is now hooked up to a family that I really wouldn't want to have anything to do with otherwise, but I trusted my daughter's romantic instincts to get with the guy who is, you know, appropriate for her. And now what happens? Now we have strife. Now we have all this kind of fallout that comes in that, in, you know, after that. So those old traditions, like, say, I don't want to call them traditions, it's just, you know, doctrine. Those old doctrines made sense. Like, for instance, like when in the Old Testament, there's prohibitions against like eating shellfish or eating pork, right? Because back then it could kill you. Mm-hmm. So why not say, hey, God says you can't have any pork and you're all going to live and we're all going to live a little bit better life. And the latent purpose of that was so you wouldn't get trichinosis. You know, it's the same thing. Like, well, okay, we're going to say you cannot have sex before marriage. And then once you do, then you can only have it this way or whatever. It made sense back then, and it still kind of makes sense today, but I don't think that is tenable now that we know more. We have too much knowledge now. I think
we have too much knowledge. And that's the point that I want to drive at, because I mean, like, the whole notion of getting, like, signing a marriage contract, which invites the state to govern your life. Let's be honest. It doesn't matter how religious you are. If you do get married in a country where the state governs that, you're basically following their rules. So regardless of what, you know, your book of religion states should govern the marriage or the behavior of the man and woman, mm-hmm. There's a totally different rule book sign once everybody says I do and goes home and leaves the chapel. Mm-hmm. The ceremony's done. Now you have the state running the show. And in fact, there's nothing in family law that encourages women to behave well during divorce. In fact, it encourages them to behave very poorly. So my concern, you know, for men, and I've said this before, like I see a lot of guys that swallow church gospel hook, line, and sinker. It's almost like a lot of churches today are like beta factories, and they mm-hmm. send guys with a great set of moral values and cues and a good moral compass out into a world that doesn't. It's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. Mm-hmm. And my concern is when guys approach a social contract, which is in fact a government contract, with a woman with high hopes that everything will be great because they preserve their virginity and hopes that they will have well, which seems almost impossible to find, that everything will be tickety-boo down the road. But I've had a lot of guys book me for coaching sessions exiting a marriage, going through the divorce machine, who had married a good Christian girl from a conservative family that wasn't broken, voted conservative their entire lives, went to church every Sunday, blah, 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 only to learn that when they're going through the divorce machine, all of a sudden she learns that there's certain things that she could do which would be advantageous to her to get more money and control of the kids, and she would go and do those things at his expense and cost, regardless of what, you know, the book of God says. So That's my big concern when guys march into the slaughterhouse, because it is a slaughterhouse. It can be. Not all women, you know, will do that, but the grim reality is all women can do that if they so choose. So I worry when men, you know, Augie, as a good friend of mine, may walk into a social contract where he could potentially end up in a really, really bad spot. So that's what my concern is. And I want to hear from both of you guys too on that as well.
Sure. Yeah, if I could respond real quick. So, and again, I appreciate your concern, Rich, and I don't take any of this personally, guys, that you disagree, because I know it comes from a place of concern and care and things like that. So I appreciate that. But so my thing is, in response to what Rolo said, I agree with what you said, Rolo, as far as making necessity a virtue. I think I've always loved that quote of yours, and to me, it reminds me of what's called the sour grape syndrome. I'm sure you guys have heard of that. And for the viewers who don't know what sour grape syndrome is, it comes from an old analogy of there's like these beautiful, luscious, sweet looking grapes that look really good. And you really want to eat these grapes. Like, these grapes are the object of your desire, but these grapes are really high up on the vine and you can't reach the grapes because they're so high and they're so unattainable. So coping with your disappointment of your inability to quote unquote get the grapes, you say, ah, they're probably sour grapes anyway. So what's, you know, I'm not going to bother. It's a coping mechanism. And I agree that there's lots of guys who, you know, their identity is one big giant coping mechanism. In my case, I don't believe that was the case. I'm good friends with people in Rich's community that have seen my girlfriend that I was with at the time. They've seen, you know, pictures of us together. She was really good looking. And the thing is, when I asked her out at church, she said that I was the only guy that ever just walked up to her and asked her for her number. Like the church is filled with betas. Like you'll definitely see that. So I've never, it's like I said, to me, it goes back to that distinction between dating experience and sexual experience. As far as the old playbook concern goes, I don't believe that truth changes just because the people of its day no longer adhere to it. I mean, the old playbook that says to not have sex outside of marriage, that says to save sex until marriage, it's the same old quote unquote old playbook that says thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not, you know, lie or cheat. Or, and just because a lot of people murder and kill and a lot of people lie, steal and cheat, it doesn't mean that that book is outdated. It just means that lots of people, you know, don't follow it. But I don't believe that non-compliance equals non-truth in that sense. And then one more thing too, if I could do a quick screen share, I would like to show you guys a couple quotes. It'll take me a few minutes just to kind of explain where I'm coming from, because you know, being a 40-year-old virgin, I've definitely got a lot of explaining to do in that regard. So let me just pull it up real quick. I'll just pull up the slides and let's see here.
You want me to add this to the stream?
Yeah, if you could add it, that'd be great.
Go ahead. There you go.
Okay. So I believe, guys, that there's two types of knowledge. Okay. And being Catholic, you know, we're kind of big on Latin. The first kind of knowledge is the kind of knowledge that I believe that governs my life in this particular area. And that's called a priori knowledge. And what that means is from what comes before, knowledge or justification that is independent of subjective experience. So a good example of a priori knowledge, and a lot of people would think, oh man, the only way that you could truly know about something is if you can experience it. Now, in theory, that sounds good. Like, yeah, you got to be able to experience something to know what it's like to have any kind of knowledge about it. But we don't actually live that in our daily lives. That doesn't play out in the real world. So here's an example. If I, God forbid, but if I had a brain tumor and I booked an appointment with a neurosurgeon, this guy's got a great reputation, he can save my life, I'm not going to say, well, I think I'm going to pass on this guy because he's never had brain cancer before. He's never experienced the need to have brain surgery himself. So I want somebody who's more experienced. Well, no, he has a priori knowledge. He put himself through med school for 12 years. He got himself probably $350,000 in student debt to learn his craft. He's done lots of successful operations. So just because he doesn't have experiential knowledge of having a brain tumor himself, that doesn't mean that he couldn't cure my brain tumor, because the kind of knowledge that he has is objective knowledge. It's knowledge that's true, whether he's experienced it or not. Same with like a criminal defense attorney, for example. I'm not going to say, well, I'm on trial for murder, so the only lawyer that can defend me is a lawyer that had murdered somebody and was successfully able to get himself out of that jam. No, his training in law school with the objective truths that he was trained in is going to make him, you know, qualified to be my attorney. Now, just to give you guys some ammo, I've actually used this argument against feminists, because feminists, what's their battle cry? Well, you don't have ovaries, you don't have a uterus, so how dare you speak on a woman's right to get an abortion? Well, the fact of the matter is, the Blackmun Supreme Court of 1973 was decided by seven guys with penises wearing, you know, black robes. They never had uteruses, yet they would never say that Roe versus Wade should be revoked because it wasn't passed by all women, right? So that's just an example of a priori knowledge. The second kind of knowledge is, I think, is the kind that you guys are fixating on, especially you, Rich, which, again, I know comes from a place of love. And that's called a posteriori knowledge. And that means from the latter, knowledge or justification that is dependent on subjective experience or empirical evidence. So that's what I would say is where the sexual knowledge would come in. And I think those two terms go together well, because that's where we get that term from the Bible. Like Adam knew his wife, Adam knew Eve, that denotes sexual relation. As a matter of fact, there's a legend out there. I think this has been disproven, but it was kind of interesting when I first heard it. The F-bomb is actually not a cuss word. It's an acronym. It stands for for unlawful carnal knowledge, because fornication was illegal in lots of European jurisdictions. And it was unlawful carnal knowledge of someone you're not married to. That's the technically the origins of the F word. But for me to be able to live celibately, it does require virtue. And I don't mean that in the sense that I'm more holy or more self-righteous than everybody else. The word virtue literally comes from the Latin word virtus, which means moral high character, goodness, manliness, valor, bravery, courage in war, and excellence. And it literally is a combination of two words. It means manly strength. And I got to say, guys, it does take a lot of manly strength to still be willing to interact with women, to still date women, to still be in relationships with women and hold that back. Like, it is very difficult. And it's actually the virtue of chastity. I'm sure you guys have heard of G.K. Chesterton. He was a great Catholic author. And one of my favorite quotes of his is he said that clear thinking is the reward of chastity. Now, you guys make a very good living basically pulling guys out of wells that they jump into because they didn't think clearly. You know, like the old saying goes, they were thinking with the little head instead of the big head. I guarantee you that the main reason why a lot of guys get themselves in the situations that they're in is because they have this really good sex with these women and it clouds their judgment. You know, Rich, you know, one of your trademarks is more red flags than a communist parade. Well, what makes somebody miss that communist parade? The sex is so good, right? Especially with BPD type chicks. One more quick quote, then I don't want to hog the spotlight here. But this is what the Catechism of the Catholic Church actually teaches regarding the virtue of chastity. And that term chastity is from the root word of chastise. Okay. Because they come from the same word family, because when you practice chastity, you're literally chastising your lower nature. Like you're curbing. It's like you're curbing the desires of your lower nature, like you do with an unruly child. And you guys both have daughters. You know what it's like to have to curb the appetites of a child. Like it can be it's very tough. And it basically says that chastity includes an apprenticeship in self-mastery, which is a training in human freedom. The alternative is clear. Either man governs his passions and finds peace, or he lets himself be dominated by them and becomes unhappy. Man's dignity, therefore, requires him to act out of conscious and free choice as moved and drawn in a personal way from within, not by blind impulses in himself or by mere external constraint. Man gains such dignity when, ridding himself of all slavery to the passions, he presses forward to his goal by freely choosing what is good, by his diligence and skill, and effectively secures for himself the means suited to this end. So I did have one more quote, but I wanted to, let you guys weigh in. I don't want to do all the talking here. Maybe I could pull it up at a later time. So that's why I believe in the virtue of chastity. There's multiple reasons why I do. The practical reasons is, like I said, I believe that sex, I don't believe that sex can be separated from morality. I know, Rolla, you talk about how you like to try to keep the red pill amoral, but I believe that sex is an inherently moral act, because we lose sight of this because of the birth control pill, but people forget that sex is an activity at its core that's designed to make the participants parents. Like, when you have sex, it feels great, but you're doing an activity that's designed to make you a parent. And that makes a moral claim on both people, because a human life could come into the world as a result of this. And that human life needs the stability of having a mother and a father that are definitely tied to each other in a sacrament of marriage. So, that's kind of my thoughts.
Okay. So let me throw it back to Rolo on this to kind of take a look at this from his perspective. So Is it a good or a bad idea, from Augie's perspective, to enter into a marriage as a virgin without full understanding of what he's getting into? Because
without a full understanding,
without having those experiences, without having like the full knowledge of what he's walking into, because he's going into it from my perspective as an outside viewer. Like, what I see is a guy following a set of instructions, a rule book that doesn't apply to the item that he's assembling, for example.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that frustrates not just Christians, but certainly Muslims as well, and anyone else who's looking for their perfect virgin bride, is finding a woman who's on the same page as they are. When I talk to guys, particularly guys who are a little bit older, and I don't mean like, 40 years old, but like even in their early 30s, they're looking for the woman who has the least amount of damage. the woman who has the least amount of baggage, the woman who is not a single mother, all the things that are on your like 6 or 7 bullet point list, you know, every time you're putting a tweet out there to, you know, that makes the 6 o'clock news for what women ought to be for men. And God forbid, you know, like, we've empowered women so much right now that we've entitled them to pretty much just do whatever the hell that they want to do and with zero expectations. And I think the biggest problem I think that most guys, like, people think I'm anti-marriage, and I'm not necessarily anti-marriage. I think that the institution of marriage is a good idea. Again, it's one of those things when we're talking about like premarital sex. Yeah, it'd be great if that was something that was tenable. It would be great if everybody could just like get together, meet their one, and live happily ever after, without the state coming in, and, you know, a gynocentric state coming in and pretty much ruining what used to be an institution that was good at putting men and women together and putting families together. At least in theory, it was. So I don't necessarily think that marriage is a bad idea as an institution. I just think the way that we do it right now is completely, you know, off kilter and hasn't been right for a very long time. So when, you know, when we talk about marriage of the greatest generation, like back in World War II or something like that, when we look at that, your grandparents or your great grandparents in this case, maybe, you think, oh man, wouldn't it be great if we could go back to that romanticized time? Well, you know, they had their problems too. But at least people knew what it is that they, you know, they men knew what was expected of them, and women knew what was expected of them. Now, all of that's off the table now. So things have changed. Same thing in the Old Testament, when I was talking about like how polygamy was a norm back then in the Middle East and still is in Muslim societies right now. And nobody bats an eye at it because that's just how they do it. And women are on board with that because their belief set, and at least in Islam and in Muslim cultures, there, if you go and you talk to like a guy like Abu American, you know, he's got 4 wives and they're all part of his, you know, I guess 4 wife harem, because they're on board with it. That's what they've been taught. That's where they're at. I don't know if they were virgins or not or whatever, but, you know, let's just say figuratively they were. The reason why they're where they're at right now is because of that belief set. Those beliefs are eroding left and right. And I'm not saying that's, you know, oh, well, that's, should we just get back to that? Should we just like all decide that we're all going to go back to the old ways of doing things? I think that when we talk about like a priori truths, and we talk about things, what we're really doing is we're coming back to a sort of an absolutist belief set. And it's I mentioned this in the first part of book 4, is that it's next to impossible. Well, it's impossible to argue with God. So if God is your source and that's your belief, then for me to say, well, to have any kind of disagreement, like if I say you probably shouldn't get married, you know it's probably a better idea that you do it in a different way, or you try to find a workaround, or you try to do these things, if I go and I say that to somebody who says, well, God says to get married no matter what, then that's it. There's no arguing against that, because that's the absolutist moralist perspective. So if I go and I say, well, you know, I had this debate with Dr. Everett Piper, and we were talking about marriage, and I took the counter position. I said, you know, today marriage doesn't make sense. And he said, well, the only way you can have sex, the only way you can have a family, the only way you can be a man, the only way you can do any of this stuff is to be married. And I said, okay, fine. How about if we just change it up and we say, okay, we're going to keep the state out of it and you can have a covenant marriage. Is that cool? No, that wasn't enough. You have to do, there still has to be the fail safes of the state for women, because this generation of guys, you know, going back, I'd say at least to the boomer generation, still believe in having that kind of state run marriage. But again, the idea of getting married is okay if everybody's on board with it. But even then, there's still the fail safes. There's still the government. There's still all the stuff that you were just talking about a minute ago, Rich, with respect to divorce and all the other stuff that goes along with that. It's not what it used to be. But if I am a Christian, or if I'm somebody who believes in that absolute truth, it doesn't matter. I'm supposed to have faith in God that I'm not going to get raked over the coals in divorce court. That's just the way that it's going to work out for me. And I can't argue with that. I can't, if you have somebody who is that dedicated to that conviction, this doesn't matter how much reason you try to say, hey, look, maybe you want to think about this. It's not going to make any difference. You can't argue against the absolute truth of whatever it is that that person believes in. So jump off a bridge. Well, I think that would be a bad idea. Well, God said I could jump off a bridge and that's what I'm going to do.
Okay. I got a fictional example for you, Augie. Let me just hit these super chats before I lose them up here. So Hunter said, most men in churches come off like they have a dark side, as if they are secretly cannibals, all smiling and too joyful. I'm not sure what he means by that.
No, I think he's getting into, I think,
the dark side of church in what sense?
I agree with what you said before, and I think you probably read the I have a pretty well trafficked blog post called Losing My Religion. And I go into I've bounced ideas off of Dalrock for over 10 years right now, and part of that was I told him, I said, you know, today's, at least maybe in Catholic churches as well, but certainly in Protestant churches, they seem like beta farms. The men that are still there, and I have done the statistical, you know, research for this, is that men who are still left in church right now are there usually because their family is there, or they're dragged there by their wives because their wives happen to be religious and they say, this is going to be the church that we're all going to go to, and this is my, you know, my choice. And most men are just go along with it because, you know, just go along to get along, happy wife, happy life. But more and more men are leaving the church right now, and I mean abandoning it in numbers that we've never seen before. And I think a lot of people, particularly on a liberal progressive side of things, think that's great, right? Oh, finally, people, you know, these guys are wising up. No, there's still a lot of women in church. In fact, church is basically for women right now. Even in the Catholic church right now, there are more women than there are men. There are more Catholic missionaries that are women than there are men.
Let me hit the super chat here from Artful Dodger. He says, it feels like as time goes on, it will be harder to meet girls who haven't done OnlyFans or are other provocative forms of online entertainment. Hang on, let me just pull him back in the stream. We lost him for a sec. Or other provocative forms of online entertainment. Is this leaning towards black pill thinking or a new norm? I think it's just the direction society's heading in. It's quite clear that things aren't going to go back to some golden era of society where there was no hypergamy and solipsism didn't exist and every man had a wife. That's old world narrative thinking that really never even existed to begin with. Even back thousands of years ago, you know, some of the richest, most successful men had massive harems of women, some as large as thousands of concubines. Mm-hmm. So
powerful men used to have a lot of women.
Yeah.
Tribal chiefs had a lot of women. Dynastic emperors of China had the Forbidden City where all their concubines were. Even Abraham in the Old Testament had maidservants. They weren't called concubines, but they were basically concubines.
All these things that he's talking about here, like OnlyFans and, you know, the forms of online entertainment that women are using today, it's there just to facilitate their nature. And, you know, there's nothing wrong or right about it. It just is what it is. It's like one of the things that you've just got to come to accept. I got two more super chats here and then we'll hop back into the dialogue. So Juan says, so where in the Bible does it say that the state has a say? So kids and money, shouldn't that just be between the participants and God? Yeah, well, you'd think so. But at some point, you know, the government decided that it was going to start issuing marriage licensing and deciding what would happen with the untying of the knot. And because women are and always have been the protected sex and men have always been the disposable sex, family law was written in such a way that it would protect and enrich the mother's life. And she now today gets 80% of the custody orders. And in many cases, men are left in ruin. So it doesn't matter what the Bible says about, you know, kids and marriage or, you know, the division of assets, for example. That's just the way the world is. And you have to accept that is the way that the world operates today.
Well, primarily it's because we rely on an old social contract in a new world order, right? In a new order right now. the reason why we still have, like, we have the divorce laws that we have, or we have the custody laws that we have, was because those are the, I should say that the basic underlying principle of the laws that would, like, say, predispose a court to give custody to a woman, it used to be in defense of that woman. I mean, if you can go and you can look in the Bible, even, where it will say, you know, look after the widows, look after, like, the one I was, I think Augie was quoting this before, is that I guess it was the Pharisees tried to catch Jesus in a, you know, sort of a paradox here, and saying, well, it says in the Old Testament that if a man dies and his wife is to be remarried to his brother, and if that guy dies, then, you know, the next brother and the next brother and so on. And so there's seven guys that die, and then the woman dies, and who gets the woman in heaven? Well, the presumption is that there's still, like, marriage or union or whatever, you know, these human, you know, understanding of the hereafter, who gets the woman in heaven? Mm. Well, Jesus says nobody, because there's no giving in marriage or anything like that. But the thing is that was the tradition. The tradition was that to keep it in the family. And the tradition is that, you know, in certain Muslim cultures, that if you strap a explosive to your chest and you blow yourself up, you've got 70 some odd virgins waiting for you in the afterlife. that's another thing I wanted to talk about too, is like when we talk about sex, particularly when it comes to premarital sex, religion has done a bang up job in using men's strongest drive to get them to do things that they wouldn't otherwise, like, rationally, they would never consider. What is it? Joe Rogan was talking about this one time. He said, you know, no woman wants to blow herself up for some dick, right? You can promise a guy 72 virgins in the afterlife if he blows himself up, and he'll happily do it. But no woman, you have to really find some other way to get a woman to do that, because men are cheap and eggs are expensive, right? Mm-hmm. So because of that, those basic, the basic reality that we live in, if I can say, look, you can't have sex until you get married, then I can do a lot of things. Like, I talk to guys on the Christian side of things, evangelical guys who got married early, met their brides when they were 17 or 18 at church camp, got married, and they're in sexless marriages right now. But the reason that they rushed to get into marriage was, first of all, they were very blue pill. And then second of all, that was their only means to get laid, to solve their reproductive problem, to have legitimized sex with another woman, with a woman, was to get married to that person. And so therefore, if you think that that's not a very useful rule for, you know, organization, for human organization, particularly men who are very interested in stuff like that. That's why another reason why another study done by The Economist is they did this research on cultures where polygamy was the norm, and polygamy, being what it is, it's usually for powerful men, like a men with status, men with wealth, men who can basically back up their walk, right? They're entitled to more women. So if you've got a guy that has four wives, that means three other dudes are sitting there with their dick in their hand, and they're told that the only way that they can get a woman is either to, you know, pull a trigger or go strap a bomb on them. So those are some of the, you know, the nuances. Yeah. In those cultures, in those polygamous cultures, they tend to be more violent, tend to be more war-torn, tend to be third world countries, because those guys are still focusing on trying to figure out how they're going to solve their reproductive problem. They can't get married. They can't get laid. They can't watch porn. They can't, you know, like, because of convictions or belief or whatever, they can't do those things. So what is left to them? Well, I can certainly kill people, and that's okay. And I can certainly do these things so that I can, you know, I can be a trigger man for ISIS, and they'll give me a bride. So those kinds of things lead to, you know, social, you know, let's just say antisocial behaviors as a result of that. So when you're using those biological imperatives, they're very, very controlling. You want to know why 68% of Christian men are quote unquote addicted to porn? It's because that's their workaround. that's the contingency plan right now. And they agonize over it. They get to the point of suicide because they can't cure their pornography addiction, because either they can't get laid or their wives won't have sex with them or whatever else. And suddenly the promise of legitimized sex dries up because they never understood why they were getting into it in the first place. Go ahead. Sorry.
Augie. I don't know if we got his audio here. I'll deal with the super chat real quick while he's figuring that out. He says, this is Myron, Unplugged Fitness, here to support 567 views. Just give this video a thumbs up. Thanks, brother. Augie, do you have audio there? You might want to leave and come back in if you're having a hard time.
Yeah, we lost your audio, my friend. Did he come back? No.
He'll come back in a second.
Yeah.
I wanted to propose a, here we go.
Are you there?
Sorry about that, guys. Yeah, internet. Okay. Jumpy here, the Wi-Fi.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the thing, and very well said, Rolo, by the way. And the thing is that it's one of those weird things, like, you know, as a believer in God, it's like, okay, we look at all these options. Like when God created the universe, when he created the natural order of things, I don't know what was going on in his mind. Like it says in Romans 11:36, who knows the mind of the Lord? Who has been his counselor? I don't know why God set up things the way he did. And I'm not going to pretend that I'm some brilliant theologian that has the answer. Like when it comes to human procreation, think about this, guys. I mean, you know, Catholic moral theology distinguishes between reproduction and procreation. Animals, without the use of reason, brute beasts, they reproduce. Human beings, on the other hand, procreate. And the thing is, when it comes to human procreation, I don't know why God set it up the way he did. He didn't establish it to where humans grow on trees, or humans are bred underwater, or they're grown from the soil or grown in vines.
What do you mean by procreation when you say procreation? You mean like humans have sex for the purpose of reproduction?
Right. In other words, procreation is the act of creating a new human being through the sexual act, basically.
So that's simply not true, because humans are the most promiscuous animal on the planet. I mean, for every 1,000 instances of sexual intercourse, and we have sex in so many ways that can't possibly result in pregnancy, oral, anal, whatever, it just doesn't add up from that perspective, because usually for every 1,000 instances of sex, there's one pregnancy. So it's not an accurate statement, though. You see what I'm saying? From the observer's perspective, based on facts and reality, that's what I see. Whereas, you know, you're saying that it's a, you know, sex is only for the purpose of procreation.
No, not at all, Rich. And I probably should have been clear on that. So here's the thing. Human beings, sex is not only, the Catholic Church teaches that there's two aspects to sex. Mm. And they're in this order. It's called the unitive and the procreative. And they're in that order. Contrary to popular belief, the Catholic Church doesn't require every single act of sex to result in creation of a child. Number one, that's not how God set it up. But two, the purpose of sex is to unite the spouses, but also to propagate the human race. So, I mean, if God truly wanted every act of sex to result in a pregnancy, it would have happened that way. Mm-hmm. But where I was going with it, we don't believe that, actually. But what was going with that, though, is that for some reason, God designed the production of new human beings to come through the act of sex. He made it extremely pleasurable, because if sex wasn't pleasurable, we would all go extinct, right? We wouldn't have no incentive to have sex, just like he made food tasty. Otherwise, we would starve to death. But the thing is, once you untwist the unitive from the procreative, and a really good guy to read about this is a Catholic saint. His name is Saint John Paul the Great. He was a recent pope we had about 3 papacies ago. And he wrote this entire series called The Theology of the Body, where he talks about how the human body has a nuptial meaning to it. And he draws all kind of parallels between the human body and scripture. There's no way I could flesh it all out now here. But the thing is, when it comes to the sexual act, because us human beings have the use of reason, that's what distinguishes us from the animals, Ritz. Like, I know you say that we're the most promiscuous species, and that may be true, but at the same time, we have the use of reason. So, like, in other words, when your dog is in heat and he doesn't have control over sexual urges, you take him to get neutered. But when a human being is horny, wants to have sex, we actually, unlike the animals, we have the ability to say no. Just like you say, the things you can't say no to, you're a slave to. Mm-hmm. That's because we have the use of reason, unlike the animals. Mm-hmm. So that can be governed.
It still doesn't make you immune from the impulse. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
I think one of the disconnects that I get with a lot of guys is they will say, well, and this can be applied to a lot of different ways, but a lot of guys will say, well, they don't believe in the red pill, right? Or they want to make the red pill like an ideology, and I don't want to believe in it, or evolution. I don't believe in evolution, as if it's some sort of like act of faith. It's like, no, it's just a predictive framework is what it is. The same thing with really any sciences, but like the red pill is a predictive framework. And so when I'm talking to guys and they'll say, well, you know, when we talk about like carnal urges, or we talk about like maybe you're hungry, that's another thing that is part of your physicality, right? Whatever it is, whatever keeps you alive and is antisocial, we tend to call that like sin, right? When we talk about like seven deadly sins, for example, greed, you know, lust, pride. I don't know all of them, but all of those sins can be correlated to a human need or something that makes sense to us logically from just a carnal, like visceral need or way. But we have to have some sort of control over those, because if we don't, we can't live in a cooperative, you know, we're social animals. We can't live in a co-op basically with people killing each other or banging each other's wives or whatever else it is. So we tend to call those things sins, so that people will behave themselves and we can go on and propagate as a species. But what happens is this, is I think what happens is a lot of guys will say, well, we're above all that. We've evolved above all that. We have free will. And so therefore we don't have, the stuff that would make us watch porn, the stuff that would make us overeat, the stuff that would make us greedy, the stuff that would make us, you know, malicious, whatever it is, we're already above all of that. And so therefore that doesn't count anymore. And so now our rational, reasonable minds, because we have free will and we can make these choices, it comes down to personal responsibility. And I think one of the things, the biggest problem, particularly tradcons have and a religious set has, is that they don't want to believe in predestination, or they don't want to believe in, determinism. They don't want to believe in like solid determinism. So that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of guys reject evolution, because it sounds like it is in some way giving license to going and banging a lot of women or whatever else, right? Well, that's just what you're wired to do. I remember when this book came out, it was, what was it called? The Selfish Gene. When The Selfish Gene came out and guys were reading it, particularly in the pickup artist set, women lost their minds because they thought, well, this is what guys are going to use to justify why it is that they're dogs, right? Why it is that they're players, why it is that they're spinning plates. It's just my selfish gene. I can't help it. The devil made me do it. Well, rather than the devil made me do it, it's evolution made me do it. My selfish gene made me do it. My whatever, you know, insert whatever, you know, biological deterministic fact that you can in there, that made me do it. But what happens is these guys, so that's one side of it. The other side of it is this, is that there's this over-reliance, I think, on guys who say, well, we've evolved above that. And they don't necessarily have to be religious. I've had the same, I've locked the same horns with guys like Dr. Jeffrey Miller, who will say, well, I live a poly lifestyle because I'm above all this. I've eroticized my jealousy instinct, and I'm a special individual because I'm so intellectual that I have used my rational mind and I've lifted myself above all of my animal instincts and everything. And now I can enjoy myself because I know that I really get off on having variety and a lot of, and I'm okay with guys banging my wife because it doesn't matter to me anymore. And all of those things that made me sort of like this human animal, like jealousy, libido, like all this other stuff, all of that doesn't make any difference anymore because now I have this over-reliance really on my rational, I'm above it all, basically. You're either above it all intellectually or you're above it all religiously. And that separates you, I think, from your physicality, because the condition that we live in, the operative state that we live in, is this human body. It's breathing this air. It's being hungry. It's being horny. It's being whatever else. And so I think that we do ourselves a real disservice as human beings when we live like when we gross out on one, like the super rational and the super reasonable and the super free will, or going and just living like an animal, like living hedonistically, there's a balance between those two. And I think that when we have problems with like conviction and belief and everything, it's usually one or the other. It's usually the guy who says, you know what, screw it all. Life is short and brutish, and I'm going to get as much as I can out of this. Or else there's the guys who are living above all of this because they think that, you know, they convince themselves that they are above it all, when in fact they're not. That's why we have 68% of guys who are 68% of Christian men who are addicted to porn right now because of that operative visceral state.
Are these married men or are these single men that are addicted to porn that are?
You know what? It's all over the internet.
No, I'm just curious. Now, I just wanted to share a quick story with you, Augie, because I have an aunt. I think it's my mom's half sister. She lives somewhere in Europe now. I don't know her too well, but I remember, like, she's been married 4 times, and on her third marriage, she got married to this guy who's quite successful. Similar story to you, right? You know, preserved himself for marriage, quite successful, had accumulated a nice little nest egg. And I've been sitting here thinking about all the different ways that this could turn into a train wreck for a guy getting married to somebody with an old world operating manual. And shortly after they got married, of course, you know, the wedding night, they get into it and she finds out that there's no compatibility whatsoever. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. I heard all kinds of stories about it being all his fault, didn't know what he was doing, and there was no sexual compatibility, and she basically took half his shit and left. So there's one of several hundred different ways that this could potentially go sideways. I mean, you don't buy a car until you test drive it, in my view. It really should be the same anytime you engage anything on a long-term basis with women. I mean, there's all kinds of problems that can come out of it. Like, there's women that have their insides, what do they call it? A tilted uterus. So it's like having a 6-gear transmission, and you can only use like 4 out of the 6 gears because there's certain gears you can't use because it hurts. Right. You could run into problems like that you would not be aware of until you say, I do. And you go home and you're like, well, I happen to like that move, but I can't do it because it's too painful for it. Right. There's any number of things that could come out of this that may not serve you later on down the road that could be problematic. And, I think it's worthwhile having this conversation and examining some of these different ideas here. I got another super chat here from Rurik. He said, in my first port of call in the Gulf, it was explained to me that the guys over there had guy friends for fun and wives for reproduction. Also, have you heard of the pink swastika? Does anybody know what he means by that?
No, never heard of the pink swastika.
Rolo, does that ring a bell?
It sounds to me like he's trying to say it's what, feminazis or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sounds like he was in the Navy. Maybe it's something Ryan might have some experience.
Can I speak to that last concern you mentioned, Rich? I thought of that. I mean, and here's my thing, guys. I probably should rephrase the notion of I'm quote unquote saving myself for marriage. I wouldn't actually word it that way, which people think, dude, you're a 40-year-old virgin. What do you mean?
Okay.
The way I get it is this. I've had a relationship with Jesus since I was a child. I love Jesus. I live for him. I try to go to daily mass. He's my Lord and Savior. And the thing is, when you have an encounter with Jesus, Christianity, like contrary to popular opinion, I'll speak on Catholic Christianity at least. Mm-hmm. It's, believe it or not, it's not a big set of rule books. It's not an old playbook that says, don't do this, don't do that, don't have this kind of fun, don't have that kind of fun. Even though it seems that way on the surface, at its core, what Christianity is an encounter with Jesus. It's an encounter with a living person who died on the cross for us. So in order to initiate that encounter, he actually initiates the encounter with us, and we have to respond. It's like it says in 1 John 4:19, we love because he first loved us. So the entire existence of a Christian, of being a disciple of Jesus, is a response to his initial outreach of love to us. So we have to say yes to Jesus. When you say yes to Jesus, the flip side of that coin is that by incident, you say no to other things. So if I say yes to Jesus, that means I have to say no to screwing people over in business. If I say yes to Jesus, that means I have to say no to lying, to killing, to having sex outside of marriage. Like, fornication is one of many things that you say no to, but you're only saying no to it because you said yes to Jesus, if that makes sense. So
what me being what do you think of Roosh's approach to life today? Because he's now found the God pill and he's let go of many years of fornicating to, I don't know, live in a mountain and grow a beard and his hair long and all that sort of stuff and preach this new version of life. What's your view on somebody like that that's been fornicating all of his life and all of a sudden now finds God?
Well, it's funny because the pseudonym name that I picked is Augustine, and St. Augustine is called the Doctor of Grace. And if you ever read St. Augustine's life story, he was a playa. I mean, he had a child out of wedlock that died when the child died when he was 21. He had mistresses. He had a late life conversion. One of his most famous quotes is, "Late have I loved thee." As far as Roosh goes, like I said, I'm not trying to make any enemies or troll anybody in the manosphere. But when I heard about his conversion, people call it him taking the God pill. Mm-hmm. When I found out that it happened while he was on, I think, was it on shrooms when he had that? He claimed that he was taking
it. Was part of it anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I heard that I'm going to be honest, that kind of threw me a little bit. I'm not going to doubt somebody's conversion, but I believe that if somebody truly repents of something, the Greek word for repent is metanoia. And literally the very first words out of Jesus' mouth that are recorded in scripture in his public ministry is metanoia, which means repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. True repentance is not only saying, "I'm sorry for what I did," but it's also undoing the damage of what you did. And if I'm not mistaken, Return of Kings is still online. The book, the Bang books are still for sale. Mm-hmm. So if someone had a true repentance, they would tear that down. And I haven't seen it torn down yet.
He did unpublish some of the stuff. I'm not sure what it was. I'm just curious as to
what Kings is now more or less defunct. Nobody's like putting anything new on it right now.
Yeah. I have a question. So if you can repent your sins, so if you can kill somebody and then go to confession and be forgiven for your crime,
To put it simply, yes. It's not that simple, but yes, in essence, that's true.
Okay. So why is there a set of rules that are supposed to prevent you from killing somebody, from coveting thy neighbor's wife or anything like that, if you can be forgiven for violating that set of rules? So, I mean, like all of these single moms that are in church now that have obviously had prior relationships, sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds, are they free to marry a good, man of God today because they've gone and done that? Like, are they worthy of a man like you, for example?
I'll be honest. That is a conversation that I have with every woman I date, when it comes to their sexual past. That is part of my vetting process. And it's not that I would stand in judgment to them, like, "Oh, you ex-whore, how dare you sleep with all those guys before you met me?" But it would more be like the practical side of things, like you guys talk about, like her pair bonding abilities. Is she still in touch with her exes? I've dated women that had abortions in their past. Matter of fact, when I was in my early 20s, one of the girls I dated, she'd been away from God for years. She was raised Catholic. She was away from the church because she had an abortion. And I actually took her to confession and we prayed the rosary in front of the abortion clinic she had her abortion in. So, I looked past it because I looked at it like, okay, the selfishness that was in you to cause you to kill your child, if that selfishness is still there, I can't marry you. But I didn't want to not marry her because she had the abortion. It was more so because the abortion to me was like the symptom and the side effect of an underlying selfishness that I found was still there. And that's why it didn't work out.
I got another super chat here from Ben. He says, "Protestant here. This conversation shouldn't be about women. It should be about placing God as the center of your life. Be blessed." Thanks for the super chat, man. Amos, I pulled you in because you've been patiently waiting in the green room area. You wanted to chime in on some of these topics?
Yeah. So, there's a lot. I was just making a lot of mental notes here. One of the things, you brought up a really good question, and I think there's going to be a bit of a difference between what Augie and I would necessarily agree upon. I come from what would be considered the more Protestant evangelical background, whereas Augie is coming from the Catholic background. So there's different views on, like, the whole thing with repentance. A lot of people ask, "Will you just go and ask for forgiveness and then all is forgiven?" Not necessarily. That word metanoia that he mentioned, that people commonly use, there's a difference between penance and repentance. So penance, just asking for forgiveness, versus repentance is metanoia, basically means to change your ways. So it wasn't just to actually like go in confession and, you know, all is good. Now, and then here's where
Return of Kings, like if it was a true repentance, why is Return of Kings still online?
That's right. But true repentance in the Bible was basically to change your ways. It was like forgiveness was a means to kind of like give you a second chance to be better. You know, kind of like what you talk about with doing the work. It's like what I've started to tell people is really just, it's not about like sitting there and groveling and being guilty of all the past, you know, problems you've had. Just make better decisions, move on, be better. So there's that. And then there were some thoughts that I had, I wanted to add to, I mean, there's a couple, there's some of the super chats that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of add in a little bit of like more of the Christian stance. I know, you know, Augie and Rollo here have passed, you know, being in the church and stuff, but I think it's, I wanted to kind of add my take on, for example, there was the one about men having a dark side in the church and, you know, how come they're like, you know, so smiling and joyful. That's basically just this culture of like trying to be happy. It's this like overly nicety kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, I've made this comment to some friends that used to be in church and I'll just ask them like, you know, I mean, isn't it kind of weird? And I'll see this Christian men that are posting pictures with family or certain family members, and they're just way too comfortable with people. Like there's no sense of reality of like, you don't always get along with your family. Like there's no family that I've ever come across that's perfect or has some like great relationship. So I see these Christian men that have, you know, they have better relationships with their sister than they are having with a girlfriend. And it's like, that's a little weird, but you get, so that's, there's that. And then, what was it? There was another one. Let's see. Yeah, the Bible talking about, you know, having a say with kids and money. The whole thing with Christianity and the church and marriage and a lot of things that happen within the church that a lot of people don't really get is that a lot of that wasn't part of the beginning of the church. The beginning of the church, there was no building, there was no offerings, no pastors, really. People would get together at homes, break bread over a table, and they'd spend hours talking about life. They wouldn't, it was very much a philosophy of life, not so much this religious institution that we see now. The Catholic Church, you know, it, for a lot of the good that it does do, unfortunately can't, is an institution of religion for the most part. Not that I disagree with it, I have nothing against Catholics, but it's just its origins was in some ways, I believe, not very Christian. This building, this organization, priesthood, all this stuff, it became a state of itself. I'm, you know, me being very libertarian, any sort of like centralized system that tries to control a good idea like Christianity, I believe, is it ultimately doomed to have a lot of problems down the line. You have, I mean, the church was one of the most powerful systems in the world for a long time. It pretty much controlled multiple countries, you know, swayed the opinions of kings and queens. But the whole thing I wanted to also touch on was just my take on what's kind of wrong with like, why is,
before you kind of move on to the next thing, I just wanted to have a little history journey on what marriage is. Bible's been around for what, 2000 years?
Well, we've got before Christ
and after Christ, right? It's about 2000 years, right?
The very first book in the Bible is written over like 5,000-6,000 years ago.
Oral histories of the Jews.
Yeah.
Right.
And we've got monolith structures that are like 20,000 plus years old sitting on the earth. So there's a lot of shit going on before somebody wrote that book.
Exactly.
But as far as marriage goes as a history, you know, the origins were originally from around the time of agriculture. And this is all based on Stephanie Kuhn's study from Marriage: A History, which is a great book. You should read it if you're interested in how marriage came about. But it had nothing to do with religion. It had nothing to do with children. It had nothing to do with show up at the altar as a virgin or anything like that. It was all about the acquisition of in-laws and everything else that came out of that. Like there was even times back then where you would get divorced and the father would have custody of the children and any assets that came into the marriage as well too. Mm-hmm. But you know, as a function of evolution throughout time with the application of religion and different versions of it. Like I find it interesting that we've got three religious guys on here and you all have a different worldview of your interpretation of how you apply it to your life. Like Rolo's is different from Augie's, which is different from Amos. And then outside of that, we've got all these other, you know, I don't know how many different religions.
40,000 denominations.
Yeah. 40 to 50,000. And they all think that they that they're right.
They've got a monopoly on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And here I am sitting as the atheist going, okay, well, I'm just going to believe what women are doing. Because that's the only accurate measure that I can apply to making choices and decisions.
I believe that the core of Christianity was meant to allow for that freedom to express yourself, sort of, some Christians will say, making your faith your own. Like, your own faith with God, however that looks, is between you and God, however you walk that out. Now, there's definitely things that, you know, so if I tend to take a look at more of the, like, considered like the gracious side of it, like, well, you know, not everything is going to be the best thing to do for you. So some guys are going to be complete betas with Christianity. From a faith stance, I'm kind of like, you know, that's you, man. I can't tell you how to go about that, but I just think it's better if you're going to make yourself your mental point of origin. Like, Red pill has, like, I think strengthened a lot of some of my views on faith instead of weakened them. It's rewired things rather than completely overhauling it. Yeah.
So I would say the same thing, Amos, is that the red pill has definitely made me a better Catholic. I've even told this to Rich in private. And my thing is this, as far as, well, two things I want to touch on real quick is that, firstly, the notion of the 40 to 50,000, you know, denominations, not to go too tangled in the weeds, but as a Catholic, I'm kind of the observer of that in the same way Richard is as the atheist, because I look at all these competing Christian denominations that conflict with each other. And that's a fairly recent trend. It's a European trend that started 500 years ago at the Protestant Reformation. And I blame that on what's called sola scriptura, which is Latin for the Bible alone, where Martin Luther basically said, I'm going to interpret the Bible privately and it's going to mean whatever I think it means. And then people disagreed with him and then people disagreed with those people. Finally, it splintered off there. But the other thing I wanted to touch on too, real quick, regarding the sexual experience aspect, which again, I'll admit, I don't have that. But I believe that there are three types of love. C.S. Lewis actually wrote a great book on this about how love is distinguished. And not to give a quick Greek lesson, but there are three levels of love. So the lower level of love is the kind of love we all have together. It's called phileo. It's called brotherly love, the love between friends, right? Like, it's where we get Philadelphia from, the city of brotherly love, right? And then the second level of love is what I think a lot of the red pill focuses on, you know, what we call the sexual marketplace, intersexual dynamics. That's called eros. That's the sexual romantic, quote unquote, love between a man and a woman. And the way I vet a woman for sexual compatibility without having sex to her, and again, I know I'll probably get trolled on this and I'm sure I'll get made fun of, but I don't care. I look at the Song of Songs, which I believe is just as much inspired scripture as the Gospel of St. John is. They're the words of the Holy Spirit is spoken by men. And the author of the Song of Songs wrote very explicit sexual poetry to his wife. So, you know, what I look at is, if I'm dating a woman, can I read the book of Song of Songs and feel an urge to procreate with her after reading it? Like, can I apply Song of Songs to the way I feel about this woman? And if I can't, you know, I wouldn't go further. And the same would go for her with me. If she doesn't feel that towards me, we wouldn't go. The final level of love is called agape. That's the love with which we love God. That's the ultimate love. So I believe that a husband and a wife, or boyfriend and girlfriend, you have to work with those three loves, with the phileo love and with the agape love. It's kind of like a sandwich, kind of like a hamburger. Like, you got the bottom bun and the top bun. The bottom bun's the phileo, the top bun's the agape, and the eros is the meat in between. So I have to practice eros in a limited way, because again, because I said yes to Jesus, I have to say no to sex outside of marriage, but I still have a little bit of that hamburger bun to work with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, let me just grab these super chats real quick. Popsky said he's also a virgin at 36. The more work I do on myself, the less I think about it. I keep approaching. That's the battle with yourself. It's not religious. And another one here from SD says, wish there was this type of open dialogue without fear of social alienation in my parish.
Yeah, that's a big problem in the church. There's a lot of difficult topics that you're not really allowed to discuss it. I wanted to touch quickly because the big problem with why marriage is the way it is, why churches are becoming a big beta factory, in my opinion, is a couple of different things, like obviously social changes, feminism coming about in the last 60 years that have made huge sweeping changes in our laws and our systems that make marriage unpalatable for most people. But also because of the nature of, so what is agape love? Agape love is what is actually unconditional love in the Bible. It's what God has for the church and what he really has just for the world.
So that's a really good example of something that is not accurate with women's behavior, because women can't love a man in an unconditional way, or in a way that a man hopes she can love him, because they have concepts.
The way the church wanted to
do his first book, right?
Let me throw something in here real quick, because this features real heavily in the very first part of book four. One of the biggest problems, I think, that whether Catholic or Protestant or whatever, when it comes to concepts of love, is that the concept of love that most religions refer to right now is based on courtly love. It's based on this chivalric notion that love should exist in a feminine primary, a feminine specific way. So if you go back and you look at like the old school rules for chivalry, which, by the way, the Catholic Church was very, very involved in back in history. So you go back to the Middle Ages and you have all these guys beating the hell out of each other because they're, wealthy, moneyed landowners. And the church has to step in and find some way to organize this because the church needs funds. And so what do? They install what's called the chivalric code. And the chivalric code is not opening doors for girls or taking care of little old ladies or anything like that. It was basically don't hit a man when he's down. Have some rules. It was kind of like sort of like the bro code for back then, pretty much. That was chivalry back in the Middle Ages when people were like, when guys were brigands, basically, and they're beating the hell out of each other. So we installed the chivalric code. Well, fast forward about 200 years from there, and we go, when we have courtly noble women who are very wealthy, who are part of the court. I can give you names if you'd like. But what they do is they install what is really feminism 1.0 into chivalry. And now it's chivalry, but defend milady's honor, do all these romantic gestures, everything that we consider like that Dr. Phil or Oprah considers romantic, or keeping it fresh, or all of these things that men have a prerequisite to do. And when women complain, how come their chivalry's dead? And we laugh and say, feminists killed it or something. No, chivalry is alive and well right now, because it's in the churches and it's in our popular consciousness right now. We just don't call it what it actually is, which is the romantic ideal. And that romantic ideal was installed in the church as well. So you've got chivalry and you've got the romantic ideal. So when we talk about marriage today, when we talk about love, when we talk about agape, this and this kind of love and that kind of love and everything, it's all centered on one thing, which is the romantic ideal. And that started, like I said, back in Western culture, back in really around the early Renaissance, the high Renaissance periods. And we've carried it over to where we are right now. And that is our old order way of thinking about things. And the problem that we're running into, you want to know why the red pill is upsetting the apple cart so significantly, is because it is pointing this out. It is showing this to the church right now. Pickup artists had to show the guys in church what was really going on with the women in their church, and they didn't want to see it. And that's one of the reasons why the red pill is so radical. And that's why you get guys who want to go, I'm going to start my ministry in the red pill, because that's where all the guys went. Everybody left the church. And where did they go? They came online and they wanted to figure out what the hell was going on. How come the women are the way that they are? How come, like, I have a burden of performance? Women know that you have a burden of performance, and they mix in that romantic ideal to your burden of performance. And now it's everything is focused on them. And that's one thing I think that MGTOWs get right, is that we have this preconception that we have to measure ourselves by how well we perform for women. It's not how we perform for ourselves, what our mental point of origin is. It's how well we make her happy. Happy wife, happy life. That right there is romantic ideal from way back in the Middle Ages. So, anyways, what I was to say is that the romantic ideal right now, it's something I focus on in the book. It's so complex that I can't. I'm glad I'm writing a book about it, because I certainly couldn't put it in a 90 minute show.
Yeah.
Real quick, Rolo, brother, you hit the nail dead on the head. And I hope your book, I hope you still have time to throw a scripture verse into your book if you haven't thought of this one yet. If you get a chance, Rolo, check out Luke chapter 16, verse 8. Because you almost repeated verbatim what Jesus said. He said that the sons of the world are more shrewd than the sons of light in dealing with their own generation. In other words, lots of Christians are very naive, and atheists out in the world like Rich, who don't have a religious belief, are actually a lot more informed on things that Christians should be informed of, that a lot of Christians have to kind of, I hate to say it, look outside the church to get wisdom in certain areas that are lacking in the church.
Because we've emasculated the church. That's why. Yeah. Because men who actually knew something. I hate it that we still have this old order idea that church is patriarchal. It's not. It's entirely, it's the power behind the throne is really the women in the church. The guy who's up there on Sunday is only there because he's the guy who's the organizer. Everything else is happening really for economic reasons, but to appease, like I said, the church is there by women, for women, as a result of this romantic ideal. Sorry, go ahead.
It's matriarchal.
It's getting there. It's certainly gynocentric.
I wanted to add quick, because talking on a whole like agape love and such gets really confusing for especially a lot of Christians that hear this. So the problem is people tend to, so Rich knows and Rolo knows we have a Religion Zero where we talked about is the Bible red pill. We did a second part to the one that episode. And then we touched on something that was really interesting. That was talking like, because a lot of people will try to like, okay, is God this? Is God that? Is what he doing here? Is that really red pill or blue pill? But what people don't really understand is within the paradigm. So I'm not trying to like get preachy on like what's true, what is, but within the paradigm of understanding God, his relationship with the church and with mankind is not supposed to be the same. It's representation, but it's not supposed to be the same as what we have with each other. So we talk about this eros. We're having men and women who are married and they have this relationship, and God talks about how marriage is supposed to be a representation of his relationship with the church, but it's not exactly the same thing. That's why there's agape and eros. Agape is this unconditional love that his view towards humanity as this, you know, it's his creation. He has complete love and support for humanity just from his perspective. We can't do that. We can definitely put a lot of our, you know, heart and soul into someone in our life. You know, falling in love, you know, being with someone as he wanted it to happen, but it's not agape. It's not supposed to be this unconditional idealistic view of love. There's still, I think, Rolo, you kind of said with your wife, like, she's not your best friend, but she is the most important person in your life. Yeah. And people,
wife, there's a difference between best friends and wives. When I said that, it was in response to guys going, oh, I married my best friend. And it's like, well, no, you married a wife. There's a substantial difference.
But it's this understanding that a lot of people don't really understand is like, it can actually a truly like, healthy relationship between a man and a woman can actually in some ways be more than friendship in certain ways. It's a different kind of relationship that is different from brotherhood, from just regular friendship. But so they kind of think of it like, because again, and then this is a whole other idea within the church where they separate the spiritual and the physical. They think whatever is in the flesh, you know, sex, eating, indulging in any sort of pleasures or indulgences are all sort of sinful or have some sinful nature to it. And then anything that is higher, that is, you know, going to church, reading the Bible, these are all better things. And they don't realize that this is a Gnostic idea. Gnosticism being this unhealthy understanding that those are separate. They're meant to be the same. We're both spiritual and physical at the same time. You know, Jesus didn't come around as some ethereal creature in the Bible floating around. He was an actual physical body. You know, he ate food. People joke like, well, you know, Jesus farted. Jesus had to go use the bathroom. He did all these things like normal people did. So he's not, these things aren't separate. So when Christians are going around kind of like thinking, you know, oh, you know, I don't have lustful thoughts. I don't look at a woman that way. And, you know, I wouldn't do that. Or this is a wrong thing. Or this is a right thing. They don't really, it's the separation. And then through that separation, they get really twisted in the head. That's why the Bible belt becomes the divorce belt, the, you know, the gay porn belt, the all this other stuff, because they separate the two in an unhealthy manner. And
one of the things we need to remember, and I did this, it was about a year ago, and it was the last convention I did, but I did a workshop with Elliot Hulse about red pill and religion and stuff like that. And I started the workshop out by saying I think a lot of people get lost in the weeds with like sort of the earthly sort of like why would God need hands to walk? Why would God need, or to, you know, legs to walk? Why would we anthropomorphize God? Someone who like something that's beyond our comprehension.
The
right?
Bible says we were made in his image.
Right. Well, are we made in his image or is he in our image? There's a really good quote in Alpha God, which says, I forget which one it was. I think it's Theophanes or something like that. It says that, you know, if horses had gods, the gods would look like horses. If horses could make idols, their gods would look like horses, because the only frame of reference that we have
right.
of anything is whatever we can perceive with our ears, with our nose, with our eyes, everything else, because our senses are so limited. But even our experiences are limited. Gravity, breathing air, fire, water, whatever it is. You know, I'm horny, I'm hungry, I'm whatever. All these kinds of things. We have to apply that because we have no other frame of reference. And I'm of the opinion right now to experience God is just to sort of like say, you know what? You've got to like put all that off. You've right, got right. to like, you know what? They open your, at least open yourself to some sort of possibility that, you know, God is more than just this magic dude in the sky in some with a white beard sitting on a throne somewhere, because that's the only thing we can think of. That's the only
reference. Yeah.
Like Christians, there's gravity in heaven, right? There's time,
right.
in heaven. There's marriage in heaven. All of these things that we think are going to be part of the afterlife or whatever. 70 virgins, and why would you need? Why would that even be an issue when you're in the afterlife? Because you can only compare it to the life that you're living right now. That's the same thing for love as well. So when we think about like, well, what does God think about love? Or what do we think about like conditional love or unconditional love or anything like that? How do we even know that an emotion, love, which is an emotion, or fear or anger or jealousy, which we also attribute to God? How do we know why would that even be a thing to an omnipotent, omniscient, timeless, all powerful thing? Who cares? Why would he get jealous? There's nothing else. I'm the only thing there is.
Yeah. You know?
And I don't think we think beyond that. I don't think we think beyond where we're at right now, what we are.
A couple of things before we wrap up, because I do have to go and do another show privately in 15 minutes. Let me hit these super chats and I'll let you guys go around with your closing thoughts. Hunter said, it seems that many churches have become a business only selling ideas and sermons to what people want compared to what they need.
Yeah.
I believe it's always been that way since day one.
It has, but it's more efficient now. It's entered entered what I call the hustle economy. All that stuff when we talk about like, you know, these hustlers and selling their offers and doing all this other kind of stuff, and we streamlined everything with the internet and everything, it's moved from the televangelist into the hustle economy right now.
There's Rich Cooper's used CRT needle. I always love seeing that guy. Chat, thanks, man. And Nico, he says, watching from Australia, Trump 2020. Thanks, man. Guys, go around real quick. So the topic was about, you know, before the train wreck and entering into a marriage contract as a virgin. Closing thoughts, guys?
Yeah, I guess I'll give my closing thoughts. So, I mean, like I said, I see marriage as more than just a contract. To me, it's a sacrament. It very much resembles the human body. We have an invisible soul, a spiritual nature mixed with a material nature. I would consider the state kind of the body and the spiritual aspect, the soul. But in closing, guys, I want everybody who's watching or listening to know I'm no better than anybody that's on the panel. I'm no better than anybody who's watching the show. I'm not more righteous than you. I'm not holier than you. I'm not holier than thou. I'm just a guy who has loved Jesus. He has saved me from lots of things in my life. Maybe one of these days I'll give more of my story in further detail. But I said yes to him at a very young age because he said yes to me. And I love him. And love is action, right? It's one thing to say you love someone, but are you willing to carry your cross next to that person if they ask you to carry the cross? And I'll be honest, being a celibate man in this day and age or in any age, it's hard. It's a heavy cross. I'm not going to act like it's easy, but it is very liberating. And it's made me free to be the best version of myself. And one day I'm going to keep dating. And one day when I'm ready to be a father, I'm going to settle down and have a family. And Rich, I really care about your, I really appreciate your care and concern for me in that regard. So that's my closing statement.
All right. Amos.
Closing thoughts. Basically, I mean, marriage, I do like what Augie's saying, kind of like marriage is meant to be a sacrament. Just kind of like it's a good idea to manage, you know, you were saying in the beginning of it, it manages, you know, the exchange of property or acquiring in-laws and such. But in the Christian sense, it was meant to be just a way to represent the relationship God had with humanity, which was this union. You know, we were made in his image. We have this union with him. It was supposed to be a representation, but not an exact copy of it. So we're obviously fallible creatures. We're not made to just be loving each other unconditionally. We have needs, we have urges, there's evolutionary stuff. That's all part of us. But, you know, whatever kind of came about in religion tried to make good, obviously the system, you know, government laws and such made it suck. And a lot of people tend to think, I was kind of adding this to before we're going into closing thoughts, is mental point of origin. Christians have a struggle with this because they think mental point of origin is like meaning sort of selfishness. Whereas, you know, Rollo made some good points talking about sort of how, you know, we briefly went back and forth on the, you know, we're made in the image of God. And a lot of people will, you know, they think like this making, you know, being interested in yourself is like some humanistic selfish idea. My view on God is really just sort of like a God and me are together in this. So I still have my mental point, you know, I am my mental point of origin, but in me is him. So he's connected with me, one with me, sort of part of my life. I don't have this separateness where it's like, because a lot of people tend to pray to God, which I have nothing against. I'm kind of like, you know, he is with me being the God of my life. So we're sort of in this together. It's not like I'm in the driver's seat or he's in the driver's seat. It's this, there's a spiritual understanding called, it's really be too much to get into, but basically there's this connection between man and God that is sort of indistinguishable, like you're one being. It's, but anyways, that's how you can kind of work around the whole mental point of origin. It's not selfishness. It's just taking care of yourself. God obviously makes decisions that takes care of his people and his interests. So should we.
Yeah. If I could add one last thing to that, Andy, the way I balance that out, because I agree with the mental point of origin thing when I first read that. To me, I balance that out as, yes, I'm my own mental point of origin, but I balance that out by making God my mental point of destination. And those two things work together perfectly. That's how I reconcile that in my life.
Rollo, closing thought.
I'm not going to give you an altar call.
Put your head down. Put your hands up.
I think that our experience of God is limited by our human experience. I think that to call God a he or a she or you know, to anthropomorphize a metaphysical being, I think it's so far beyond our ability to even imagine or have a concept of that. We lack the faculties, I think, to really wrap our heads around it. And so we kind of clumsily, you know, say, oh, well, he is like this or he is like that, or this is what, and that's not a masculine or feminine thing. I'm just saying that's like a human. We want to say, well, God looks like us. We're made in his image. And so therefore we're a reflection of that. And so that's the only way we can really understand it. And I think we need to push past that. We're at a point right now where we need to sort of, I don't know, move on from that to something that's a little like, at least be open to the possibility anyways. When you look at, like, say, the history of religion, we've gone from like these sort of shamanistic world spirits, like the spirit of the forest, the spirit of the wind, the spirit of this. And then that moves into sort of, pantheism or, you know, the gods and the goddesses. And now we're applying as civilization sort of gets more collected and more organized. Now we have a need for like a pantheism, or we have a need for polytheism, I guess would be better. And then once we get to like nation states, and once we have empires and stuff like that, and it's, now you see the gods and the goddesses giving away to one god. And now from there, where do we go from there? Can we get away from the idea that God is just this anthropomorphic being, or are we stuck? Are we just going to be stuck here and we're not going to be able to move past that? I don't know. But again, it's like, these are things that I'm trying to figure out for myself right now. But I think that we're very limited in what we can experience, or what we can even, I don't say experience, like conceive of what, you know, is right. What is great? What is a metaphysical, you know, thing? And we're happy to listen to guys who say, well, you know, I'll shove a crystal up my ass and that'll make everything better. Or it's the secret, right? Or it's the law of attraction, or it's whatever. And it's so you've got all these guys who are trying to throw answers and throw stuff at you. And I think maybe it's time that we just kind of step back, because a lot of the organized religion and a lot of the things that used to be practical and pragmatic and efficient, that had a latent purpose to it, we kind of got to go, you know what? That's old order understanding. And we have this new order data that shows us why do we think that way? Why do we do these things? Yeah. It made sense then. Does it still make sense now? Some of them, yeah. Some of them, they might. But in others, we go, okay, well, you know, how do we live a better life as a result of this new data? So I don't know, that's me. New book's coming out, I swear.
quick note from my channel sponsor. I got to thank Scott over at Grondike. So Tactical Soap and Beard Oil. If you go to coopersoap.com, the coupon code's actually already applied. You can check out there. Handmade, pheromone infused, creates helps me to create more of this content on the channel. It's all natural too, so there's no endocrine disruptors in it. So consider that. Also, I'm moving over to my community to do a broadcast for my 1%. If you're interested in networking with a community of like-minded top shelf men, check it out. It's always pinned in the top comment of all my videos. I want to thank you guys for watching today's broadcast. Rolo, Augie, and Amos, thanks all three of you for chiming in on this topic. This was an interesting and different one for me as a guy who is spiritual in the sense where mental point of origin to me is my spirituality. That's how I govern my life and make my choices. And I always look at facts and reality when I'm doing those things. And I find that served me best so far. So thank you, gentlemen. Maybe we'll do another one of these again. Guys, give it a thumbs up and a like, please. And we'll see you guys in the next broadcast.
Cool.
Yep. God bless everybody.